Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. On every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home in the Hamptons to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Join Ina as she crafts a classic cocktail with journalist Frank Bruni and discusses the ins and outs of Yorkshire pudding with actress Emily Mortimer. If you're looking for great conversations about and over good food, tune in to Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts.
This week's Splendid Table is a repeat of an earlier broadcast.
Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media. Well, today we talk with Marcella Hazan. What Julia Child was to French food, Marcella is to Italian. Starting in the 70s, she brought America a new sense of eating Italian. She and her husband, Victor, join us to talk about their autobiography. Food scientist Harold McGee muses over some recent findings. Your joints, for instance, may thank you for using that extra virgin olive oil. We talk with a guy who signed up to eat local for a year to get closer to his wife, and we're checking in to find out how that went. Then it's how a little French pickle could be telling the story of the planet. And as always, you know, in the second half of the show, we open the lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. So let's get rolling with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet magazine.
Lynn, among the things that Akron, Ohio is best known for, culinarily speaking, are sauerkraut balls, which are unique to Akron, Ohio.
I beg your pardon?
And sauerkraut balls were invented in Akron, Ohio, and in many restaurants in and around Akron, a favorite hors d'oeuvre is a sauerkraut ball. It's a sort of a small sphere of sauerkraut and ground-up meat that is kind of breaded and deep-fried.
It's like a hush puppy.
It's like a hush puppy.
Sauerkraut in it.
And it's a wonderful kind of tangy, tart, savory hors d'oeuvre.
But wait, that's off.
That's
the track,
parenthetically
Michael.
Speaking.
I don't know, Michael got very hung up on sauerkraut balls when we were there. But the reason we went down to that area was we actually went to Barberton, Ohio.
Which is a suburb of Akron.
Uh-huh. Right, a suburb. And it is famous for something called Barberton chicken. It's a regional specialty that exists only in this very Eastern European town, which is kind of a combination of Czech, Serbian, and Hungarian.
I detect there may be a line over the past couple of months here of Eastern Europe.
We're going
Europe.
Back to our yeah. roots,
yeah,
you know,
exactly.
The Stern roots, yeah. The Hungarian-Russian roots.
So this is an Eastern European dish?
That is correct, and you might sense that when you know that the name of the restaurant that first served it there is called Belgrade Gardens. And they first started serving this in 1933, and now there are a handful of restaurants in and around Barberton that serve it. And there are a couple things that make it different than ordinary fried chicken. For one, it is always cooked in lard. No vegetable oil here. And this lard, of course, as you know, Lynn, gives it that unspeakably luxurious crust. I mean, that quite literally melts in your mouth.
Mm.
And, you know, it encloses chicken that just drips with flavor. The other thing that's unique about it is that it's cut the old-fashioned way. And I think this must go back to 1933 and the Depression, you know, when the idea was to cut a chicken so that you got kind of maximum pieces from it. So the chickens there are cut into wings, drumettes, breasts, legs, thighs, and backs, meaning that, you know, you're going to get pieces of chicken with meat where you don't expect it. And it involves a certain amount of tooth and tongue work to get it all, but it's really good.
They serve it with a hot sauce
side,
which is not super hot, but it's sort of like a creamy hot sauce. And when you put the whole thing together, I dare say it resembles chicken paprikash, which is also on their menu. And I kind of wondered if at some point they tried to Americanize chicken paprikash by separating it into separate pieces of chicken and mm-hmm. the creamy red sauce. But whatever it is, it works. And it's a place that's been there, as Michael said, since 1933. And it is a giant restaurant packed to the gills every single night.
Now, is this a sort of a fancy place, or is it?
No.
It's not.
Well, it's sort of both.
It's both. I mean, you would go. People, I think, do go there to celebrate their anniversary. You know. On the other hand, you don't have to dress up to go there, nor do you have to make a reservation. It's one of those places that has a ritual meal that people grow up eating and then take their kids to, mm-hmm. who then take their kids to.
You know the chicken dinners in Kansas City?
Yeah. Yeah.
That have that ritual. They start with the vegetable soup and the Michael, what do they call honey buns, the big cinnamon rolls, and the fried chicken and the do-do-do-do. And, you know, there's a logic to the meal, and it's the same here. You get this particular appetizer, this particular tomato rice on the side, the hot sauce, the mm-hmm. lard fried chicken. Barberton and Akron, we found to be the most wonderful food that nobody seems to know about except people who are lucky enough to live in that area. And maybe it's because Michael and I both are Eastern European descendants, but we were crazy about it.
Who could resist a sauerkraut ball? But guys, thank you.
You're welcome, Lynn.
Bye, Lynn.
Happy eating.
Stick shifts and safety belts. Bucket seats have all got to go when we're driving. In the car, it makes my baby seem so far. I need you here with me. But when we're driving in my Malibu.
Jane and Michael Stern are the authors of Two for the Road. Now, you know that you can hear the Sterns here every week, but you can get their food finds anytime. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. You know, I've got this image in my head. Summer is a guy. He's this hunky, yet, of course, deeply spiritual, blonde, godlike type. And he's trying to exit so that fall can take over, and I'm dragging him back. Don't leave, I beg. Just one more basket of tomatoes, please. Just one more perfect peach. And then I promise I'll quit and I'll do the apple thing and I'll even cook rutabaga. Well, that's all to explain why I have got just one more tomato recipe to share with you. It's a soup which works now that nights are getting nippy. It's from Italy. Why are we not surprised? And it's a good way to use up stale bread. I call it marble cutter soup because it comes from the Tuscan mountains where Michelangelo used to get his Carrara marble. Well, men are still cutting the same marble from those hills, and they eat a special tomato bread soup right now. Basically, the soup is a rich, fast-cooked fresh tomato sauce, stretched with water, and then finished with hunks of bread that kind of soak right down into it. The last touch is olive oil, black pepper, and if you want to, some cheese. So, you can find Marble Cutter Soup on the website, splendidtable.org. McGee has endeared himself to all of us cooks who have control issues. McGee is a food scientist with endless curiosity about every aspect of food. His book on food science, on food and cooking, is the Bible of every chef worth his salt. Harold also does the occasional column for the New York Times under the appropriate header of The Curious Cook. Harold, it's good to have you back.
Good to be with you, Lynn.
Harold, I noticed in one of your columns that you made a link between extra virgin olive oil and ibuprofen. What are we talking about here?
Well, it came as a surprise to me, too, and I was reminded of the fact that there was a connection when I went to an olive oil judging and experienced in a very concentrated and intense way how pungent olive oils can be, how they can kind of catch you in the back of your throat and make you cough.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
That turned out to be the key to the discovery a few years ago that extra virgin olive oil contains a natural version of ibuprofen. And it was a flavor chemist who had never tasted really fresh olive oil before, and he was at a conference in Sicily. I happened to be there watching as this happened, and he took a sip of the olive oil of someone who had come to the conference and had brought a bottle to share with people, and he had a coughing fit. And he said, told me afterwards that he immediately thought of ibuprofen because in his work as a flavor chemist, he had worked on the irritating qualities of ibuprofen and tried to, you know, mollify them for medicines and things like that. So he immediately thought, maybe there's something in olive oil that's kind of like ibuprofen. And if it is something like that, then maybe it's also an anti-inflammatory the way that medicine is.
So is it actually an anti-inflammatory?
Well, what happened was that this chemist, Gary Beecham is his name, went back to his laboratory in Philadelphia and over the course of a few years, because he didn't have official funding for this research, he put together the pieces and was able to demonstrate in 2005 that, in fact, there is a compound which he named oleacanthal in olive oil that acts very similarly to the way ibuprofen does and that it does have anti-inflammatory activity.
Now, does it have to be, I mean, is this present mostly in fresh oil, newly pressed oil?
Yes, yes. It's one of the phenolic compounds that are, in general, the antioxidants that you find in olive oil. Unusual for an oil to contain things like that, and olive oil is especially rich in them. And so it's one of those components, and it does go away with time. So very fresh oil, like the oil we tasted in Sicily, is the best way to get its effects.
Two things that come to mind. First of all, we hear so much about what inflammation may have to do with all kinds of serious ills. And this could be pretty remarkable. But the second thing is the Mediterranean diet theory.
Yeah, and those two things are really coming together now because it is true that as time has gone on, people have begun to link inflammation, which is basically the body reacting very strongly to some kind of problem by generating all kinds of cells and compounds to limit the damage that it thinks it's suffering.
Mm-hmm.
It can overdo it, as when you get an inflamed a sunburn, for example. That's an inflammation.
Yeah.
When the body overdoes it, that can cause problems of its own, and it's now thought that inflammation is a part of cancer, heart disease, arthritis, all kinds of serious problems. And if you can find something that kind of dampens down the body's tendency to do that, that's going to be a good thing in the long run. And it's now thought that perhaps oleacanthal in extra virgin olive oil has been an important part of the success of the Mediterranean diet in keeping people fit and healthy. If you're having some of that oil and some of that oleacanthal every day, that maybe that's sort of keeping the body on an even keel and preventing inflammation from taking over.
Is there anything that the consumer can look for when they buy a bottle of olive oil that can tell them that the oil is going to have that property?
Well, some oils are now being labeled with the year of origin, and that's really the only good clue because color and things like that are, you know, sometimes it tells you, sometimes it doesn't.
Yeah.
So looking for a very recent vintage and if possible, going to a farmer's market and, you know, buying from someone who can let you take a taste. And if it gets you in the back of the throat, it's good stuff.
You've got it. Hey, Harold, thank you.
My pleasure, Lynn. Thank you.
Food scientist Harold McGee is author of the book On Food and Cooking. His article on olive oil appeared in the June 6, 2007 issue of the New York Times. So in the spirit of taking a little extra virgin olive oil to ward off aches and pains, try my recipe for a warm garlic olive oil dip for vegetables. It's a classic autumn dish. You can find banya cauda, or hot bath, on the website. SplendidTable.org. And while you're there, be sure to check out our newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen, our podcasts, and information on our book designed to get you to sit down and eat well with friends and family. It's called How to Eat Supper, Recipes, Stories, and Opinions. Now you can find it all at, you know where, SplendidTable.org. Coming up, the Italian who changed the way America eats, loving a locavore, and the global pickle. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. In the 1960s, an Italian woman came to New York. Now, she was going to change the face of Italian food in America, but at the time, she barely boiled water. Marcella Hazan backed into cooking and into a long career as a teacher and cookbook author. Her work was unusual because her books brought more than recipes. They gave us authenticity, the sensibility of what makes food Italian. Well, her food kicked off the whole Northern Italian craze. Marcella has written a memoir, Amarcord, Marcella Remembers. Marcella and Victor Hazan, her husband and work partner, join me. Marcella, Victor, welcome.
Thank you.
It's wonderful to hear your voice again, Lynn.
Well, I'm so glad that the two of you could come in. Marcella, in this book, you start out your story, logically, in your childhood. Where did you grow up?
Well, I was born in Cesenatico. I left there, that was just a baby, to Egypt.
Uh-huh.
And I left Egypt when I broke my arm, that I was 8 years old. And I stayed in Italy until I met Victor and took me here.
Now, Cesenatico is a little seacoast fishing town, right?
Yes.
In fact, if I remember correctly, the port was designed by Leonardo da Vinci.
Yes, I think you were there, no?
Yes, I was, when I took your class.
Okay.
I remember it was very beautiful. But, Victor, you grew up where?
Well, it depends what you mean by growing up. I was in Italy until the age of 11.
Uh-huh.
And then my parents moved to New York City. But I always felt that something had been interrupted. And so as soon as I was old enough to make up my own mind where I wanted to go, I returned to Italy. And I wanted to recover something of my interrupted childhood. And instead, I found Marcella.
How did food come into this, teaching cooking?
Well, I had to feed Victor, which was always talking about food, which I was very... very surprised, because for me, I never thought about food. I was not interested in food. But he was talking always about food, and that was very strange. Don't you think that a person court you and talk always about food? Well, I found it very strange. But anyway, I listened, because I never cook in my life. But when I married and came to America, I had to do it. But it was not very easy. Supermarket was something that I never saw in my life before. Everything there was dead. We were used to have a chicken running in the courtyard before to catch it and cook it, you know?
Yeah.
And I tried to remember the taste and the smell and the look about the food that I was eating at home and try to recreate it. Everyone asked me how I learned how to cook. Actually, I don't know how to answer, because it came naturally. I didn't know
that I could do it. There's a lot of being written now about how the brain works and how we're learning and storing things without even knowing about it. And I think this is what happened to Marcella. She was faced with the necessity of having to cook for us, and almost suddenly, she knew it all. That's quite surprising.
But it was also your fault that really learned how to do it, because every time that I did a dish that was good, he jumped from the chair and came to kiss me and said, how wonderful I am. So I wanted to do more.
Totally understandable. Julia Child once said to you that you're too much of a perfectionist. How has this worked for you or against you in your career?
Well, against me because I could become tired much easier in that way. First of all, when I was teaching, I tried to teach in a way like everyone didn't know anything and supposed to know everything.
Yeah.
But also, it was something different writing a book because maybe, I don't know if you remember, but I hated to measure. And one thing that I knew that I have to give measurement for the recipe. So I was doing recipe, you know, measuring after, like putting olive oil in a cup and after look how much I use it.
Marcella, how do you see Italian food in America today? What are your thoughts about what you're seeing in restaurants and on television?
Well, it's much, much more Italian what it was before. The only problem is that they want to always to do a little more. They forget that in Italy we said that it has the same importance what you keep out than what you put in. And that I don't like. And sometimes they get extreme. Don't overcook pasta. Cook it al dente. Now you go to the restaurant, the pasta is not fully cooked. Risotto, the same thing. The rice is not cooked yet. And why they do it, I don't know.
If you have one piece of advice for a cook who wants to capture what this food can be, what would it be?
Simplicity and taste. Look at the taste first. And after, don't try to make too much things with the food. You know, you're ruined.
Marcella, Victor, thank you for talking with us.
Well, it was very nice, Lynn. Come to see us, and don't wait too long, please. Okay?
I will. I will.
Arrivederci.
Okay.
Ciao.
Ciao,
ciao.
Ciao. Marcella Hazan is author of Armacord. Marcella remembers. January 2008, we began Locavore Nation, an experiment. We wanted to see what happens when for a solid year you try to eat 80% of your diet from local, organic, and sustainable sources. We asked for volunteers. We were looking for 15 diverse souls from around the country. 5,000 applied. Well, we made our picks and our locavores began their agreed-upon blogs. Tim Baird is one of them. When he started the project, both he and his wife were PhD students at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. She's in nutrition, he's in geography. Tim, welcome.
Hi, Lynn.
So, Tim, how has this been?
This has been this has been an adventure, and I court adventure in my life. So this has been a kind of a welcome yet surprising kind of path that my wife and I have taken.
Surprising in what way?
Well, I got word to be invited to do this in, it was either late November or early December last year.
Right.
So there was very little time for me to kind of mentally prepare for completely overhauling my diet for a year. My wife was so ecstatic, there was very little room for me to duck out of of this. She was the one that forwarded me the survey in the first place. So I was kind of caught off guard, but initially I was thrilled to be selected. I think I wrote a blog entry about this early on, that just the prospect of being selected for anything was so thrilling for me that I just had to say yes. And it wasn't until January 1st, or actually maybe the late December, I was like, this is your last week of eating frozen pizza and sugar cereal.
Yes, exactly.
And that's when it set in, and it was. And for a while, there was a lot of community support. How's it going? And that fell away. But fortunately, I'm the type of person that is very comfortable eating the same thing every day. So I just found those few things that I can eat, and I've been fine.
Well, you know, one of the things that intrigued me about your application is the first question was, why do you want to participate in this year-long study? And the beginning of your answer was, because it would bring my wife and I closer together. Mm-hmm. Why and did it?
Well, I've got I've got a zinger for you today, Lynn. It has brought us closer together, quite literally. We found out a couple of months ago that my wife is pregnant.
This is a first, I think.
This is a first. I haven't posted this yet. She's just through her first trimester, and things are great. So we're very, very excited.
Oh, congratulations. That's great, Tim.
Thank you, yeah. But initially, my wife is a PhD candidate in the Department of Nutrition here at the University of North Carolina, and she is a foodie. I'm not even entirely sure what that word means, but whatever it means, that's
neither
what she
am
is.
I.
And increasingly, I've been referred to as a foodie, although I don't wear that mantle comfortably. But it did bring us together. We became much more mindful about what we were buying, about what we were cooking, about what we were eating. And then there was kind of a combined enthusiasm that we shared that was apart from our relationships with any other people about what we were doing and how we felt about it. And the type of thing that you lay next to your spouse in bed at night and you giggle about this crazy weird thing that you're doing, which is ignoring all of the food in the supermarket except for a few things and getting up early to go to the market every Saturday.
This may give us a whole new promotional angle for Locavore Nation.
Yeah, improve your relationship with your wife.
Yeah. So you said you like to eat the same thing again and again. But what are the foods that have gotten you through this?
Sausage. Seriously. Sausage.
What could be bad?
Milk.
Yeah.
We live in a huge pork state, and it is not difficult to get really high quality. There's chicken sausage here as well, but a lot of pork sausage.
Uh-huh.
I mean, obviously, the little bits of fennel and all the spices that are in there are non-local, but I have willfully ignored that.
So have you become totally obnoxious with your friends in terms of being critical of what they eat?
That's a great question. I'm actually a little bit shy about telling people. Initially, I was quite enthusiastic about it, but then I kind of realized that you're creating a distance between you and them when you tell them that you're engaging food in a very different and deliberate way than they are. And I've been reluctant to do that.
Yeah. So on December 31st, when the experiment is over, what's going to be the first thing that you go out and do or get in and start eating?
Well, see, every winter we go home to, we're both from Maine originally. So our first local dinner last year was lobster, and maybe our last local dinner will be lobster again. But on January 1st or December 31st, you know, I don't know. I used to eat a lot of Honey Nut Cheerios and bananas, and I'd treat myself to Fruity Pebbles and things like that.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if we can say that on the air, if we can make those endorsements.
You just did.
Okay. But I have really overcome an urge to buy those things. I still wander down the cereal aisle, and I kind of look, and it's like, I don't know, it's like wandering through the halls of your old high school or something. And I have refrained, and I'm wondering if I'm going to let myself get back into eating cereal again.
Interesting.
Yeah. Well, one of the things is that I've felt much more healthy in the last several months.
You got to be careful, Tim. You're becoming a testimonial.
I am.
Hey,
I am.
Thanks for being part of the whole thing.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Tim Baird is a teacher at the University of North Carolina. Pickles are like bread. They show up in a lot of cultures. Now, in France, one particular pickle is like a calling card. It's the tiny, sour cornichon. Now, for traditionalists, to serve pâté or saucisson without cornichon would be like stomping on the French flag. But recently, the cornichon tradition of France has run into an economy gone global. And it's challenging how the French think about their food. Anita Elash reports from Cornichon territory, the Burgundy region of northeast France.
À droite, c'est là que les cornichons vont être semés cette année. Là, ça vient d'être labouré.
Florent Jeancamp's family has been growing cornichons on this parcel of land near the village of Apoigny in central France for more than 40 years. As Jeancamp explains, the soil is sandy and cucumbers have always grown easily here.
Parce que c'est des terres sableuses, c'est des terres qui se réchauffent vite, comme je viens de vous dire, et que le cornichon pousse facilement.
So when the giant French food processor Maya Mora put out the call for suppliers in 1964, the Jenkins and dozens of other farmers were happy to oblige. They planted hundreds of acres and sent their produce for pickling to the Mai factory just down the road. It was a relationship made in heaven. But then it all went sour.
In 2004,
Maya Mora said they were ending their contract with us. They said they would get their cornichons from India because they were 40% cheaper than ours and that our relationship was over.
C'est fini, on arrête la relation.
When that happened, most of the farmers switched to different crops. Maya Mora stayed on in its factory using Indian cucumbers. So now it's next to impossible to find a commercially produced French cornichon that actually grew in France. That might be good for business, especially from Maya Mora's point of view, but it's not so great for French culinary pride. Because cornichons aren't just a pickle here. They're a symbol of all that globalization has done to the French dinner plate. Here at the Sunday morning food market in Paris's middle-class 15th arrondissement, vendors' stalls are laden down with regional goodies. Dried apricots and figs, fresh lettuce, apples and pears, poultry of every persuasion, piglets and their parts to roast on the spit, mounds of hams and sausages already on the grill. But tariffs that used to protect French produce have all but disappeared, so now there's a lot of competition from foreign foods. You can buy truffles from China now, and most snails come from Turkey. Here at the market, the green beans come from Africa. The tomatoes are mostly Moroccan or Dutch. There are cherries from Chile and strawberries from Spain. And that's a fact a lot of shoppers find hard to stomach.
Alors, un grand pot de blanc lisse et un grand pot de crème.
Jérôme Grandineau, who's carefully picking out locally produced cheese, says he's more and more concerned about the food he eats.
The thing I think is you don't know anymore where the foods are coming from, often. I always prefer knowing where the food comes from, because it's very often the proof of quality.
Viewed from a distance, the French point of view may seem a little quaint. Claude Fischler says that's because it is. He's a sociologist in Paris, and he's just published a book that compares French attitudes to food in a globalized world with those in the United States and Britain. He's found that Americans and Brits think they've never enjoyed so much variety and choice in their daily bread. The French are inclined to say, quelle horreur! That's because for them, food is a question of identity.
Most people have this sense that you are what you eat. And if you are what you eat and you don't know what you eat, of course, there's a problem with who or what you're going to be.
But so then where does globalization fit into all of that?
Well, globalization is exactly the problem, actually. I mean, it's part of the problem. It's fine to have something coming from somewhere else, as far as you know from where. And the truth is that you don't.
Voici notre bâtiment.
Meanwhile, back in Apoigny, Florent Jenkins is determined to keep up the tradition that his parents left him. He and two of his neighbors decided to stick it out. Now they're the last three major cornichon farmers in all of France. They grow bigger cucumbers and ship them off to Germany, where they're pickled for the Polish and Austrian palates. They run their business from the same warehouse their folks built in the 1960s to feed a hungry French cornichon market. It shares a courtyard with the Maya Mora processing plant.
Les camions se croisent, les camions indiens arrivent sur Apoigny, nous nos cornichons pour les camions.
In the summer, Jenkins' delivery trucks filled with French cucumbers headed for Germany cross paths with Maya Mora's trucks filled with Indian cucumbers waiting to be turned into French cornichons. As Jenkins says, they exchange greetings as they pass.
Ils se disent bonjour au passage.
La vie, c'est la vie. Il faut se la vivre au hasard des jours et au fil des nuits.
Anita Elash is a reporter based in Paris.
Okay, it's time for our weekly trivia challenge. Now, this week the question is, does double dipping transfer germs? We're going to be back in a moment with that answer, and we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Now, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls in a moment. The number's 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia question.
What are you doing? What? Did you just double dip that chip?
Excuse me?
You double dipped the chip.
Double dipped? What are you talking about?
You dipped the chip, you took a bite, and you dipped again.
So?
That's like putting your whole mouth right in the dip.
The question was, does double dipping transfer germs? Well, Prevention Magazine took this one on. And face it, I mean, this is a duh. The answer is that it's the same as a kiss. If someone has double dipped and then you dip in your chip, you might as well have kissed them. So, if you don't have a kissing relationship, skip the dip. It's time for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252 or email us via the website splendidtable.org. Okay, let's get a move on. Let's see who is up. We have got Sarah on the line from Seattle. Hey, Sarah, what do you want to talk about?
Hi. It has not been good tomato weather this summer in Seattle. Surprise, surprise.
Oh.
And I have probably about 12 plants of green tomatoes.
That's not a bad thing. That's not. No, but really, seriously, I mean, there's great stuff you can do with green tomatoes.
Besides fried green tomatoes.
All right. Okay. First of all, first thing that comes to my mind is green tomato pie.
Mm-hmm.
Treat the green tomato. Do half tomato and half apple.
Okay.
And treat the green tomato as though it's a Granny Smith apple.
Okay.
And season it just, you know, spice it up and sugar it just the way you
sure.
do. The apples, and you put literally do half apple, half green tomato. It will be fabulous.
Okay.
That's number one. Now, the other thing that's fabulous is taking this down the other road, which is green tomato chutney.
Oh, I love chutney.
You love chutney. And, of course, take
yeah.
anything that looks like it calls for, green papaya or green mango or apple, okay, and substitute for all or part of that fruit's measurement.
Okay.
Green tomatoes.
Excellent.
They are fabulous. They love flavors like fresh ginger garlic and vinegar, you know, sweet sour flavors.
Oh, so, that gives me a lot of possibilities, I think.
Yeah. I mean, you can do a lot with it. And you know, the other thing is that there's a wonderful pasta that is done in southern Italy in the heel of the boot. It's done in Puglia, which is done with raw green tomatoes cut into small bite-sized pieces, tossed with the best fresh ricotta you can get your hands on, and browned onion and garlic with chili and lemon zest.
Oh,
and then
wow.
you squeeze lemon and you toss that all together, and those tomatoes are sweet, sour, crunch. The lemony zest and fresh lemon, and then the creamy richness of the ricotta contrasted to browned onions and hot chili. It will make you die and go to heaven, girl. You will just think you are the happiest person in the whole world.
That gave me a chill.
Yeah. I mean, this is pretty fabulous stuff.
Yeah.
And you don't cook it. You know, the idea is you brown the onion and then everything goes into the pan and just gets tossed together and that's it.
Great.
See, you got a real bonanza there in those green tomatoes.
Hey,
I have to pay for my green tomatoes. You got them for nothing.
Okay.
Hey, Sarah, thanks for a great question.
Sure.
Okay, take care, girl.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
You can call us 800-537-5252. green tomatoes. You know, we just don't. They're gems. Trust me, they are really gems. Now, if you want to ripen them, supposedly you don't put them on a windowsill. Put them in a basket, someplace where they've got a lot of air circulating around them. Don't pile them. Spread them out. And put a newspaper over it. And supposedly that holds in all the natural gas that the tomato throws out, helps it ripen, and it doesn't really want a lot of light. Don't seal it, though, okay? And they'll ripen, and they'll be pretty nifty. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Let's see who is up next. We've got Brett calling from Baltimore. Hey, Brett, what do you want to talk about?
Hey, Lynn, first of all, I just want to tell you I've just been listening to your show for the last couple of weeks, and I am absolutely hooked. Every Sunday,
so
I make sure that I'm in the car driving somewhere so I can listen.
Oh, Brett, thank you. That's great to hear.
Well, it's fall, and one thing my wife and I enjoy doing is apple picking.
Oh, yeah.
And we love to go and just get different varieties of apples. And we've done baking, and we've done the traditional stuff with it. But what I really am interested in, because I really like meat, gamey meats,
right,
is how to cook those apples with those kind of dishes.
Ah, so you mean with things like quail or wild duck or lamb, or
venison,
right,
or anything
right
that you would really recommend that would just bring out both those flavors?
You know, I think if you think of the apple as being sweet sour, because in many cases it is, you know, it has apples can have a fair amount of acidity, some more than others. That changes the mindset from I'm making a dessert to I'm making either a side dish, a garnish, or I'm using it as a flavoring. I'll give you an instance. For instance, if you have, let's say, little quail.
One of my favorites, by the way.
Great. Take a really flavorful apple, you know, something like a Honeycrisp or maybe a Macintosh, because Macintoshes and wine saps are these sour, sweet, they're just wonderful apples. Take an apple that has character. Forget the delicious and the golden delicious. They're the most vapid things imaginable.
I agree with you 100%.
Take equal amounts of chopped up apple and chopped up garlic cloves, which is a lot of garlic.
Yeah.
Okay. Stuff that inside of the quail. Then toss the quail with a bit of olive oil, a little balsamic vinegar, lots of fresh thyme. All right. Put that in a plate or in a shallow dish, lightly cover it, and put it in the fridge overnight. Now, what's going to happen is some of that garlic and that chopped apple is going to start permeating the flesh from the inside out.
Wow.
Now, the next day, you can put these on a grill over a low fire to slowly roast them. Okay. You can put them in a pan in the oven and baste them with their marinade. Right? And give them some black pepper and salt as they cook.
Oh, wow.
Or you can pan sear them and cook them slow. And you have – leave all that stuff on the inside.
Okay.
It may not cook through. And you can always remove it before you serve it, although some people like half-cooked garlic and still really fresh-tasting apples.
Absolutely.
But you see what you're doing here is that apple is becoming this flavor. Now – if you want to go a step further than that.
Sure, I'm always up for it.
Take the same apples, thin slice them, and as you're cooking the quail and whatever, you sear them now. If they're going to be seared on the grill, so you make them like grilled onions.
Wow.
You know, if you core them from top to bottom and then cut them about a half inch thick into rings, you can brush them with oil. Okay, you can put chili on them.
Oh, wow.
You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And then you can either put them in a roasting pan, you can put them in a frying pan, you can put them on the grill, and they become a side dish.
That's unbelievable.
And the other thing is, you know what's fabulous? Is to take chunks of apple and put them in a pan, cook them with a bit of either olive oil or butter, sear them, and then add tamarind and a little broth to the pan and boil that down so that they're glazed with that sour, fruity tamarind, which is also some tamarind concentrates turn it a mahogany color. They're this deep, sort of rich, rusty red. And that is just a fabulous side dish.
I'm sold. I have to tell you, I'm just so excited because I'm just so tired of the sweet, same old sweet all the time. I really wanted to find something savory.
Yeah.
And we do this, and we have so much fun with it every year. So.
Oh, this sounds great. Use this as the jumping off place, though.
I mean, I think you've got the idea. They love almost any kind of herb. Spices are obvious. Fresh ginger, garlic, and chili tossed in a stir fry with crisp apples. Not the apples that fall apart, but crisp ones. That could
be.
Wouldn't that be a fabulous thing to put over rice and then have next to it a piece of salmon?
That would be absolutely fabulous.
I think that would be great fun now that I think. In fact, we may do that this weekend.
Well, there you go. Well, you can come over to our place.
I would love that. Hey, Brett, thanks for a great question.
No, thank you, Lynn. You have a great day, okay?
You too. Take care. Bye. How nice. How nice. 800-537-5252 or email us. Go to splendidtable.org. Commercial beekeepers move honeybee hives from place to place across the United States. Farmers hire them to bring the bees to pollinate crops. Well, as most of us know, in 2007, 30 billion honeybees disappeared, and many of them were these traveling pollinators. Well, environmental writer Rowan Jacobson has done a book. It's called Fruitless Fall: The Collapse of the Honeybee and the Coming Agricultural Crisis. Rowan, welcome.
Thanks, Lynn.
This title sounds a tad like a doomsday pronouncement. So well, what is the current situation?
Well, the current situation, things have not improved any since this first came to all of our attention about, well, really 2 years ago was when colony collapse disorder first reared its head and beekeepers began experiencing these massive die-offs. Those die-offs continued last winter. It's pretty much a seasonal thing where fall and winter is the bad time. So 31% of the bees died in the country 2 winters ago, and last winter, another 37% of the remaining bees died. So things are not looking up.
So we're talking about half the honeybees that do this pollinating. So what does this mean, essentially, to food supplies?
Well, more than 100 of our crops need to be pollinated by bees in order to set fruit.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't mean just fruit crops, but nut crops and all the things we think of as vegetables but are actually fruits, like cucumbers and squash and zucchini, pumpkins.
Right.
And so without the bees, we won't have any of those crops. Now, the bees aren't all going to disappear right away. So the place that we would feel it first is in rising food prices, which, of course, we're already seeing for a number of reasons, only being one of them.
What is causing this?
You know, everyone wishes they knew. There's been a lot of attention paid to it, and since it got the public's attention and Congress's attention, there's actually starting to be some money funneled toward research. So we're hoping to start to find out, but so far the experts who have looked into it have not come up with a smoking gun. For a while they thought pesticides were involved.
Right.
If you ask most beekeepers, they're convinced that this new class of pesticides is what's responsible. But the studies so far haven't shown that it to be an absolute slam dunk case. There's also a new virus that's appeared recently in the country that may be connected, but again, it doesn't seem like that's the one thing doing it. Most experts believe it's a combination of factors.
That's what we heard. When this first started, we interviewed someone who at that time was beginning to do research, working in conjunction with a lot of other researchers around the country, and he said at that point, their speculation was that it wasn't one thing, it was a combination of things. But this sounds like such a dramatic, you know, one day there were honeybees and then 30% of them fly away and never come back.
Well, exactly. What changed 2 years ago?
And yeah.
Nothing fits for that picture. The people who believe that it's more of a systemic thing think this is just kind of one more natural system that it can sort of, it'll be resilient to a certain place. You can push it,
and
push
then
it,
you go
but
beyond.
Then, yeah, suddenly you hit that cliff and just boom. So maybe we hit some kind of cliff.
Right. So the future? Any forecasts at this point?
You know, I think almonds are going to be the first crop that might not be able to get enough bees to get a full yield.
Mm-hmm.
So almonds are kind of, you know, going to be the canary in the coal mine here. But I do actually have some hope. One thing that's coming out of all this is an emphasis on a more organic style of beekeeping. Very different than the commercial industrial scale beekeeping that's practiced now, where bees are trucked around the country in massive amounts, 400 hives to a semi and so on.
Right.
So you're seeing smaller beekeeping operations working in conjunction with smaller organic farms, and those bees seem to be doing a lot better. So maybe that's part of the future for both bees and agriculture.
Yep. Rowan, thanks for talking with us.
Thanks, Lynn.
Rowan Jacobson is author of Fruitless Fall, The Collapse of the Honeybee and the Coming Agricultural Crisis. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. And remember, you can call us anytime, day or night, 800-537-5252. You have a great week. And until next time, let me leave you with this quote from Meryl Streep, who said, "It's bizarre that the produce manager is more important to my children's health than the pediatrician." Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media and supported by Palm Wonderful, 100% pomegranate juice in the curvy bottle. Palm Wonderful, the antioxidant superpower. Information at pomwonderful.com. Now, you can find information on nearly everything you heard here today on our website, splendidtable.org. Have a visit. I mean, you're going to find podcasts, newsletters, a recipe archive from our very talented guests, and information on our book, How to Eat Supper. Also at splendidtable.org is the Splendid Table store, where you can find products related to cooking and baking. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Judy Boudreau. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Brett Baldwin. Our managing producer is Sally Swift. We'll be back next week. You have a good one. And thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.